Sometimes materials that might be more complicated, and if you become an engineer dealing with complex materials, you might need to worry about that. There might be regions of, well, even a normal linear dielectric like water is going to become nonlinear if E0 becomes big enough. If I make the electric field externally big enough, it will just rip the water apart. Okay? And you've seen sparks. We did it to air the other day where I increased the electric field between the two balls until I actually had a breakdown. And when you have that breakdown, then you can't argue you have anything going on with this in the linear regime. So in the same way that you may be used to thinking of strings as having a linear region where as you pull them out and push them in, the force that they try to restore the system with is linear in the degree to which you've stretched it or pushed it in, so you're used to that. If you take that same spring, you just rip it, right? So then it's no longer a spring. So you can take that and go into a region where it doesn't work anymore, and that's sort of the case here. So there are limitations to the picture, but more or less, this is how you think about it. And to just give you a sense of these materials, kappa for water is equal to 80.4. That's a huge factor, right? I've taken an electric field and I put it across water. The electric field inside the water is 80 times smaller. And that's because water is such a highly polar material. By definition, kappa of the vacuum we define as 1. Kappa of air is almost 1. Kappa of oil is equal to 4.5. To just get some idea of these different materials. Any questions? So, again, because we have to keep the paychecks coming in, we need to complicate things a little bit. We define the quantity kappa times epsilon naught as just epsilon. This, if you recall, we call this the permittivity of free space. That would be this epsilon naught, okay? Free space is just another way of saying vacuum. This, which is a similar beast, but it is modified by this dielectric constant, which means it now depends on the material that you're in. This we call just the permittivity. This is a fixed thing. You know what the number is, and it is what it always is, because vacuums are vacuums are vacuums. It doesn't matter. This depends on where you're measuring it, and it depends on the material. These are one-to-one. So that means if I wanted to study how the electric field is changing in materials, I could look at a table of dielectric constants, or I could look at a table of permittivities. It's the same thing. You're just dividing and multiplying by this epsilon naught to go from one to the other. So if we imagine that we have, for example, these parallel plates, and inside these parallel plates, throughout the region inside, I put some dielectric constant, or some material with some dielectric constant kappa. We know that if we were to charge up this parallel plate capacitor, and if there's nothing in there but vacuum, we know that it has an electric field which is equal to sigma, whatever sigma is, this charge that I put on the plate, divided by epsilon naught. We know that if we now insert a dielectric with constant kappa in the midst of this thing, that a way to think about it is that the material weakens the original electric field by this factor, kappa, whatever it is. If it's water, it's a factor times 80 times weaker. Epsilon naught is sigma over epsilon. I'm sorry, E naught is sigma over epsilon naught. So we can rewrite it. So this is sigma over epsilon. I'm sorry, epsilon. So with this, maybe you can begin to see why we're, in addition to trying to make life more confusing for non-specialists, why we actually have these different constants. Kappa is this thing that's nice to use if you just want to think about what is the strength of the electric field. It is the linear thing that shows you that it's weaker. If you look at this example, though, you see that we have this relationship for the original field in terms of sigma and epsilon naught. And that relationship is preserved if you put the crud in here and you use epsilon instead. The new E is sigma over epsilon, not epsilon naught. So you sort of absorb the kappa. So usually in these kinds of, maybe the answer is actually always, if you have an expression that involves an epsilon naught, if you throw in the material, you can basically change the epsilon naught to an epsilon and think of it that way. But I find very often it's actually worth putting in the kappa. Very often it's sort of worth thinking about the vacuum fields and putting in the kappa and trying to think your way through it that way. It can be sort of subtle, and it's really easy to get confused as to which electric field you're thinking about and getting kappas and epsilons all screwed up. There's at least one problem on the workshop this week that has you having to play with all those things to begin to get them straight. Okay? Everything changes potentially when you throw stuff inside the problem. Remember, if we have some parallel plate capacitor that has a charge, potentially there's a Q equals CV relationship in there. What happens if I have a potential across this capacitor, and what happens to the potential across the capacitor if I now put a dielectric in there? Let's suppose that I've charged the capacitor up. I've disconnected it from the battery. So I have a bunch of charge on it, okay? And if I have no dielectric in there, then I know Q is equal to CV. So whatever the V was that I used to charge the thing up, and it has a capacitance, so it has a certain amount of charge on it. Now I remove it from the battery. The charge is still there, so there's still a potential between the plates, which is the V that I used when I hooked it to the battery, right? Now let's say that I put a dielectric in between the plates. What happens to the potential between the plates? How would I even begin to think about that? What is potential? Anybody? potential. Have we ever heard the word? Potential. Your mantra should be, when you see potential, you go work for unit charge. Alright? You see the guy across the room, you go, oh, he's got potential. Work per unit charge. That's what you need to be thinking, okay? Work per unit charge. So, I have charge on this plate, I have charge on that plate. If I have no dielectric in here, how do I know what it means when I say potential? It means if I take a little charge on one of the plates and I move it to the other plate, there's a potential difference between those plates. That's because it takes a certain amount of work to move it from one plate to the other. Why? Because there's an electric field in that region of space. Right? There's a force that the electric field puts on the charge, which is Q times E. Work per unit charge. So if I want to take a certain Q over there, it's going to be the distance, the work is distance times force, times E. Okay? Right? Bring me some bills, I hope. So, now what happens if I put a dielectric in there? What do you think?
You reduce the effect of the electric field.
The electric field that charge sees now is weaker. Thank you. Right? Because I had a strong electric field, and now put in the dielectric, and you don't worry about the fact that you got to fight your way through the crud. You have a charge, and you're trying to move it across. Now the field is weaker. So what happens is you've reduced the potential. So it's going to be linear in the electric field because work goes as the electric field strength. So you should expect that the voltage is going to go to voltage divided by kappa if you have the dielectric. But that's how you think through those problems. So I'm being obnoxious about it. Is you know, when you're asked anything with potential, you want to think work per unit charge and try to think of it from the point of view of that. The capacitance. Let's think our way through that. We have a certain amount of charge. We have some new capacitance, which I am trying to figure out how it relates to the old capacitance. The voltage has changed for whatever charge I move across. If I have the dielectric, the voltage is now V over kappa. The charge has not changed, okay? So, if you look at this expression and you write it, Q over V is equal to C prime over kappa, this is your old C. So C prime is really equal to kappa times C. So, if you throw in a capacitor, you increase the capacitance of the system. Capacitance is this geometric thing, and the capacitance without a dielectric, we're calling this C, and remember at some point we derived that. So this is kappa times this epsilon naught A over D, but that's equal to epsilon A over D. Here's another example of how you can take an expression that you already know, that capacitance, and how it depends on geometry. And now you put in a dielectric, and epsilon naught just goes to epsilon. This is what you would have if it were all just in a vacuum, but now what we see is that the capacitance itself, if I have a dielectric in it, you could sort of just take this epsilon for this vacuum expression, this epsilon naught, and turn it into an epsilon, and you get the right answer. Okay, so there are different ways to think about it. Maybe you don't care because you have a formula sheet, but I'd like you to sort of be able to think your way through these things. But you may have a formula sheet, but I will surely give you some problem where you have to think your way through it. I've had some discussions with a few students about the exam, and maybe some of you have sort of figured this out. At least one student said to me they did pretty well in 113, but when we talked about it, they sort of said, you know, the thing was, it was like I always had seen those problems before, and I don't know anything about the 113 exam. That isn't my test. This is not a pattern recognition class. You want to be able to think your way through this stuff. So you can have the formulas and stuff, but you need to be able to think your way through that. To me, that's what the whole course is about. So if you didn't do as well in the test as you wanted to, that's one thing to ponder, is to what extent maybe you were doing pattern recognition. All right, so that's all I really wanted to say for now about electric fields and materials. Do you have any questions or comments? Okay. Let's imagine that we have a big battery, and we connect it across some conducting metal. And what I'd like to do, though, is to take a piece of this metal, or whatever it is we've connected it across, and I'd like to blow it up. Let's imagine it's some big, thick wire. And let's try to imagine what's going on microscopically in this thing. So inside this wire, if we hook it up to a battery, this battery has a potential of difference across its terminals. And so what we say is that we now have this potential difference across any section of the wire. So let's imagine for a moment that, so we have this potential difference. What that means, though, is that we will have an electric field. Because if you have a change in potential, you'll have an electric field. Potential is work per unit charge. If it takes work to move a charge from one point to another, it's because there's an electric field there. It's all sort of circular. So there's an electric field in this wire, which is really what causes the charge to move. So you can imagine momentarily that we have that. And so in the microscopic world, what that means is that if there's a positive charge in the wire and it's free to move, it will move. In reality, that doesn't really happen so much, because even in copper or some wire, the atoms are sort of held in place in some metallic lattice. Okay, so they don't actually move so much. But what does happen is that you can imagine electrons moving in the wire. Okay? And the thing is, these electrons may not go straight. It's not so easy necessarily to go so in such a straight line. And the reason is because the electrons will basically run into nuclei and stuff. So there's an analogy that I like to use for this. Imagine that you're sort of over by the chapel, right? And you see your sweetheart standing on the steps of Rush Trees, right? And you just, the love field grabs you. And you start running toward your sweetheart to go get a hug, okay? So you can sort of imagine a conducting world where there's nothing on the cloth, and the grass is green, and you can run nice and easily. Or you can imagine doing this during graduation. when you've got 18 trillion people on the quad and you try running through the crowd to get to your suite, okay? And you keep running into people and you keep having to change direction as you run into people. And so it will take you a lot more energy to work your way to Rush Reese, okay? So different materials sort of have different density crowds on the quad, as a way to think about. Things that have what we call low resistance, they don't resist your movement, okay, we call them low resistant materials. Things that have lots of a high density of people that get in your way would be materials that we consider to have high resistance. So it's sort of hard to move the current across. So there is resistance to the movement of the electrons. All right, and just to jog your memory in here, this whole thing is going to be about electrons looking for love. All right, so how do we quantify this? If we were to take a thin element of this wire, so just a little slab, and count the electrons that go flipping across its the surface of that slab, okay? Then we quantify it, we talk about, well, these charges will flow, okay? In general, in the atomic world, you think of these electrons as flowing. If it were an ionized gas, they'll certainly both charges will flow. But the way to think about this in your mind is charges will flow whatever they are. So if I look at what crosses this boundary as a function of time, there will be a rate at which the charges will pass. And this is what we call I, which in some random instances I will label big I. So there are certain problems where we have to be really careful with our labeling, and other times in which I'll just randomly mix it up because sometimes a big I will come out and sometimes a little I will come out. This we define as a current, specifically an electric current. And we put it in units of coulombs per second, which we call the ampere, which is named after this dude. So I suppose if you have naturally curly hair, maybe you can get a unit named after you too. But there we go. So their units are amperes. All right. You good with that? All right. Listen up. Because here's the place where people screw up. Lots of you have had lots of chemistry. You know about atomic structure. When I talk about charges moving in a wire, you automatically think electrons are moving in a wire, right? The convention that we use in physics, and you can blame Benjamin Franklin for this, okay? The convention we use in physics is that the direction of positive current flow is the direction the positive charges would move. Okay? So if you do a problem and in your mind you're thinking electrons are moving and you do it the wrong way, you're going to have chosen the wrong direction for the current. which may not matter for a little while, but as soon as we get into magnetic fields, you're going to find that's going to mean everything you do is backwards from what way it's supposed to be. Okay? So always keep that in mind. We just blew it, okay? Benjamin just blew it because he didn't know about electrons and lattice structure in metals, and so he had to choose one, and he just chose wrong. So we had a 50-50 shot of getting it right, and he blew it. So, okay. Like I say, blame him, but it's a thorn in your side. Just get it right. Just remember, in physics, positive current is the direction that positive charges flow. Period. Okay? And the direction of the current flow is important. Okay, you'll have to. So in this case, in this particular example, remember by convention, if we're drawing a battery, the long one is positive, the other one is negative. So if I had to choose the direction for positive current flow, it would be like that. This would be positive direction, okay? You good with that? All right. It turns out, as you might imagine, if we have a wire and we put a little piddly battery across the wire, we'll get sort of a little piddly current because we have sort of not that much of an electric field that gets sort of set up inside that wire. If I put a real Mongo battery on there, I have a huge electric field across the wire, and I'll get a very big current. Okay, so I hope that just makes sense. So it turns out that if you go and you measure most materials, and you take the material and you make a little length of it, and you put it across a variable voltage source, and you turn up the voltage, you can plot what the current looks like as a function of the voltage. So that is, how does the current vary with the potential that you put across it? So if I plot the current versus the potential that I have across something, so I put a voltmeter there, and I'll have, you know, some current flowing through it. Ooh. Then what you'll find is that they're proportional to one another. The current is proportional to the potential, and we say that there's a constant of proportionality. Actually, I'm going to rewrite this. There's a constant of proportionality, which we call R, and R is the resistance of the material. So if I were to have material where if I have a relatively small change in the potential that I put across it, I get a big change in the current, it would look something like this. So this would be a material that has sort of a low resistance. I could imagine having a material where I might have to crank the voltage up quite a bit to get a change in the current. So this would be something that has a high resistance. So if you're into high school math, right, this R is the slope, basically, of this line. and different materials will have a different resistance. Okay, so again, you might have a table full of resistances that quantifies specific materials. So the resistance is now a constant for a given material, and we call it the ohm, that's the MKS unit, and we give it the symbol, which is a large case omega. You may think, well, I don't like large case omegas, but you should just be happy that it's not C. Those things are C. All right, so there's ohm, the dude that we named this one after. And this is known as Ohm's law. So by definition, you know, 1 ohm is this 1 volt per ampere. Again, this is the kind of thing, sort of like the spring force law, which is good for most materials over a pretty large range of things. You may find if you actually end up in lab having to do things and the resistance of the material becomes very important, you can find that sometimes materials will go nonlinear here, and this law may not be valid for that material in the voltage region of which you're using. So there are instances of that that do crop up if you're dealing with real-life laboratory. Just bear that in mind. But again, this is a pretty good approximation and a really good way to sort of think about things. It's the only way we're going to worry about in this class. You okay? All right. So when we started this discussion, I started it sort of talking about I take a wire and I put it across a battery. So it turns out that wires in general do have a little bit of resistance. It takes a little bit of energy to go through a wire. In some materials, it takes a lot of energy to go through the wire. So for the most part in this class, if there is a wire in the problem, you should think of it as having no resistance. If there is resistance in the problem, it will be inserted in the problem by something which we call the resistor, which will be a circuit element like the capacitor that will have a different symbol, and we call it a resistor. And you think of all of the resistance in the circuit as being tied up in just those resistors, and you ignore the resistance of the actual wire itself. That said, as you begin to do problems in this particular chapter where they're talking about resistances of different materials, you'll almost certainly run across ones where the actual resistance of the wire is the thing that they're talking about. So just try to keep that straight. I think it can be a little bit confusing. For the most part, we don't worry about the resistance in the wire. And this situation that I drew up here we really think of it this way. We use a symbol, which is this squiggly thing, for a resistor. So in most circuits, there are elements that have a lot of resistance, and you insert them. They're symbolized like this, and you can think of all the resistance right here, and you ignore the resistance of the conductor that's in the problem. If the problem says, you know, there is a copper wire and we change its radius by a factor of whatever, how has its resistance changed? Then you have to worry about the resistance of the copper wire. That's sort of a different type of problem. But otherwise, it's usually like this. So if we have such a situation, we know by virtue of sort of definition that we'll assume that Ohm's law holds true, so V is equal to IR. V is equal to work per unit charge by definition, because that's your mantra, right? So to get the Q across the resistor, well, let me rephrase this. So what does this really mean? This picture tells us that I have a wire on this side of the resistor and a wire that goes to that side of the resistor. Those wires, think of as perfect conductors. There's no resistance there. The potential difference between this point and that point is exactly the same as between this point of the battery and that point of the battery, right? Because this is all a conductor at the same potential as is that. So what this means when I write it this way is it means there's a potential difference across this resistor. That's what this V is. And what this says is that for a given size resistor, for a given value here, there's a current that goes through the resistor that depends on the size of that potential difference. We say that there's a potential drop across the resistor. And a way to think about it is, remember what potential is. Potential is work per unit charge. I think of the zero potential as being out of infinity or something. You can imagine an absolute potential at this point being how much energy it takes to bring a charge in from infinity and put it at that point. And the absolute potential at here would be to bring it in from infinity and put it at that point. And what we know, what we're given, is this potential difference between those two values, okay? But those are really different energy levels, right? It takes a certain amount of energy to come and bring charge here, a certain amount to bring it here. So what is this IR, this V across the resistor? That is the amount of energy it takes to shove the charge through the resistance. That's how much energy it takes for you to run from the chapel to get to your suite, right? And the more people that are in the quad, the more energy that is, the bigger the resistance is, okay? The more is the energy drop between where you were and where you're going. So people will talk about potential drops across resistors. That potential drop is IR for resistance in a current. You okay? Alright. So, I rewrite potential as work per unit charge, and the way to think about that in terms of resistors, that's how much work it takes for the charge to get through that resistor. So another way to say it is work is equal to QV. Power in a physics sense, not in a house of cards sense or whatever, is just the amount. I mean, imagine that I have a current, right? So that means I have charges constantly going through this resistor. So what's relevant if I want to know something like how much energy is lost is really how much energy is lost per unit time, because current is sort of charges per unit time. So power, if you recall from physics 113, is work per unit time, or the derivative of the work per unit time. So if I have a fixed potential, which is this battery, then this will be dQ over dt times the constant V. This is I times V. This is the current. This is the rate at which work is done to shove I through the resistor, is sort of how to think about it. Okay? So if we go back to our analogy, you're a quad, your sweetie puts their head out of the library, so you just break down the run into the library. There's a lot of people in the quad, so by the time you get there, you're gone. Okay? Where is all that energy gone? If you're really in love, you shove people out of the way. They're on the ground. You've littered the ground. The chapel and Rush Reeves with bodies of people going, what? What are you doing? It takes a lot of energy to shove them out of the way. So you've left all that energy out in the quad. Okay? So in a similar way, if I try to shove current through a resistor, you can think of the charges as constantly hitting elements of that resistor, the nuclei and the lattices, if you will, okay? And as they hit them, they cause thermal excitations. That's sort of the thing, right? That's what you're doing when you're running through the quad, is you're shoving people who then run into people who run into people. Your energy is sort of going into the thermal energy of the crowd, if you want to think of the crowd as an ideal gas. And so so that's what's happening in the resistor. So that energy that is lost, this work per unit charge that takes the shove through the resistor, is basically going into shaking up the lattice. It goes into thermal energy with a very high efficiency. Okay? And so you can assume that 100% of it goes into heat, because that's what you mean when you talk about thermal energy. So this power, as you go through a resistor, is turning into heat. Potentially light and other things, but it's a pretty high efficiency heat. So the power spent in a resistor goes into heat and or light. And we've just derived the fact that power goes as I times V. Recall that V is equal to IR. So I can rewrite the V as IR. So this becomes I times IR, which is I squared times R. I can also rewrite the current in terms of V over R. So this can become V squared over R. So again, when you have to think about the energy flow through a resistor and where it's going, how much energy is lost to heat by such and such a circuit, you might find any one of these three forms useful. They're equivalent. Okay? So, imagine that we have more than one resistor. So let's imagine we have multiple resistors. R1, R2, up to Rn, for example, and I could imagine putting those in a shoebox and thinking of this combination of resistors as one big resistor R, and I could imagine taking these two sides and putting them across a battery V, okay, some potential. This combination of resistors would be called resistors in series. And a way to think about that is if you're a charge in the circuit, you would have to fight your way through each of those resistors in series. Okay? Often, and we'll do more of this, you can think of current flow in a circuit with a mental picture that you would use for water flowing through pipes. So if I have a pipe and I have some, you know, hair stuck in different places in the pipe, so I have to shove the water through, if you want to think of it that way. If I have one pipe with a little clot of hair here, here, and here, it has to fight its way through each of the three bits, okay? So the resistance here, what you think about resistance as, there's a voltage drop across it. There's a certain amount of work that has to be done to go from one point to another. So if we think about it that way, the total potential that we have, that's the work per unit charge it takes to shove the charge through this entire pipe. But it takes, this has to be the sum of how much work it takes to move across that one, plus that one, dot, 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 plus that one. Okay, so this V has to be equal to V1 plus V2 plus up to Vn. If I just have asked how much work goes across that, this is the value V1. V1 has to be I times R1. And that is the current that's going through the thing. If you want to look at this as a pipe, if I shove so much water in this end, that same amount of water has to come out the other end. Otherwise, the pipe bursts. So in this instance, if I have current coming in here, it has nowhere else to go. So it has the same amount of current has to flow through each of these resistors. So if I look at the voltage drop across each of these resistors, they have the same I. They have different R's. I pull the I out. V is equal to I times R1 up to Rn. So V is equal to I times the sum of each of the R sub I's. Sorry, the index is the same as the current symbol. That's probably, I'll call that an R sub J. So what that means is that the resistance for resistors in series is equal to the sum of the individual resistances. Which I hope mentally just made sense, because you have to fight your way through each of these. So we can do it a different way. We could have the situation where I have two resistors. I could do N resistors. I'll do two for simplicity. And now I put them across a potential. And this time they're resistors in parallel. So now you can imagine I have a current in this wire. Think of it as water flow. It reaches a branch point right here. The water has to split. So some water goes up this way, some water goes that way. Imagine the case where I have a very big resistance here and a smaller resistance here. Then more of the water is likely to go the bottom route than would go the top route. So how much current goes which direction will depend on these resistances. However, if the amount of current I have flowing here, the amount of water coming in here, is the same as the amount of water going out there, I know that whatever these are in terms of how they're split, the sum of these two has to equal that. So I know that I is equal to I, I is equal to I1 plus I2. The current is the voltage divided by the total resistance. The total resistance in this case is as if I were thinking of this as a big shoebox around the whole thing. So So this will be the potential across R1, and this will be the potential across R2. Because this is all one wire, the potential across this one and the potential across that one are the same as just V. So this means that 1 over R is equal to 1 over R1 plus 1 over R2. Or if I'm going to do resistors in parallel, 1 over R is equal to this 1 over R sub J. Okay, so with those two laws, you can now take any arbitrary combination of resistors and successively break it down into things that are in series or in parallel and turn out and find out what the equivalent resistance is in the whole thing. So there's a point of confusion that can sometimes happen if you look at it that I promised I would mention when we talk about capacitors. We talk about how you think about capacitance of things that are in parallel and in series, and now we just did resistances in parallel and series. And what you'll notice is that if we look at capacitors, parallel, series, resistors, parallel, and series, you'll note that for capacitors in parallel, it's linear. For resistors in parallel, it's linear. And the others are these inverse relationships, okay? It's easy. You just got to keep it straight. Obviously, you can put this on your formula sheet. Fine. But you still will sometimes need to keep it straight. Here's how I think about it. The one I remember is this one. Because I know if I have a bunch of resistors all lined up in series, I have to work my way through each of them. So the total resistance is the sum of those resistances. Okay? That's how I think about it. So I remember this one. And then I know if that's in series, the parallel is the other one. And capacitors are backwards from that. That's how I remember it. So you'll have to come up with your own way of remembering it. But invariably, you can sometimes end up mixing this up, and then obviously you get it wrong. All right, so before we quit today, I have one other thing I want to do, which is I want you to think your way through something. Let us suppose that I have wires that have no resistance, and I put the resistance in two places. And these resistances are actually nails. So I have a long nail, and I have a short nail. Okay? The rest of the circuit, you don't need to worry about. The nails, assume, are made of the same material and have the same process. So you only need to worry about the length. I'm now going to put a huge voltage across this thing so you get a big current. The nails are going to melt. Which one's going to melt first? Everybody who thinks the short one will go, raise your hand. Everybody thinks the long one will go, raise your hand. Same time. Alright, let's see what happens. Long one, short one, okay? Short one first, long one second. Why? What causes it to go in the first place? What melts it? The heat. What do we mean when we say heat in physics? It's power. Energy per time. Power goes how? Power goes as I squared times R. What's changing here is the resistance. This resistance is certainly longer, which I think is what deceives many people and say, oh, that one's got to go first. It is true, since the resistance is longer, if the current were the same, that one would go. But the current's not the same. because this resistance is longer, there's more resistance. Same voltage. V is equal to IR. Resistance here is less, so there's more current. Power goes as I squared R, so the more current wins. Even though the resistance is larger here, more current, power goes, so the short one burns out first. All right? Okay. See ya.